Okay, thank you. I'm very glad to have this opportunity to talk about some of this work. Now, this is a result of some ongoing program I have with Mike Duff and another collaborator, Fred Dilks, the postdoc, who's since left the field, actually. Things move pretty quickly. And a student, Hisham Sati. And as you can see, some of this is old work. What I'd really like to get to at the end of this talk is stuff which I'm finishing up just this week, which hopefully will appear early next week, I think, before the 4th. But we shall see about that. So the reason we got interested in massive gravity is through the so-called ADS-ADS brain world, or some people might say the Karsh-Randall brain world. So in order to introduce that, I wanted to just flash some view graphs quickly on sort of the Randall-Sundrum model as a lead-in and explain what the ADS-ADS brain world is about. Now, of course, a feature that got me interested right at the beginning is that this sort of brain world model predicts the trapping of a massive graviton. And certain alarm bells should go off when you think about massive gravitons, mostly because they propagate 5 degrees of freedom in 4 dimensions instead of 2. And it's been shown some time ago, this Van Den Veltman Zakharov discontinuity, that the sort of massless limit of a massive graviton is not the same thing as a generally covariant massless graviton itself. So you wonder if it spells disaster for the model. I'm going to claim in the end, of course, that it does not, and that there's a gauge invariant or a diffeomorphism invariant way that the mass arises from a four-dimensional perspective. To begin with, the Randall-Sundrum brain world has gotten a lot of attention. As a sort of a Kaluza-Klein person myself, I thought probably the most fascinating feature is that you can have sort of an infinite extra dimension and yet still trap sort of an effective four-dimensional zero-mode graviton on the brain. Now, you've probably seen this metric many times already. This is basically just anti de Sitter space, phi, on both sides of the brain, and just sort of a kink in the middle. And it's basically the properties of this kink, or in just this point of view, a thin brain, that's responsible for the trapping of the graviton. Now, of course, it's still originally a five-dimensional model, so you still have, in addition to a four-dimensional graviton, sort of a continuum tower of Kaluza-Klein gravitons. And the result of that is, from a four-dimensional perspective, you can see there's sort of a standard Newtonian law of potential plus certain corrections of that nature. And I think, well, for example, Giddings, Katz, and Randall made a nice calculation involving brain bending that demonstrated this correction with that correct two-thirds coefficient. Now, we had shown some time back that another way to interpret this model is basically just through sort of holography of the brain world, that you can think about it as a conformal field theory in 4 dimensions on the brain, sort of coupled to gravity. And if you do sort of a four-dimensional quantum calculation, you can reproduce the same Newton's law. And that looked like a nice check of sort of duality or holography in the Randall-Sundrum model. And so in a way, what I want to talk about, I'll end up, is a similar sort of check in the bent brain world model. But before we get there, one step at a time. Now, it's a nice metric, and it has all these nice features and properties of trapping a graviton. But of course, you know, it's an easy thing to write down the metric. What you really like to do is to be able to say, where did it come from? There's some Einstein equation or something. And so the original Randall-Sundrum idea is perhaps a bit of a toy model, but just basically to note that you have a five-dimensional anti de Sitter space, so we can take sort of a five-dimensional Lagrangian with cosmological constant, and the brain is modeled basically by energy density on the brain, which I denote tau RS, to sort of the Randall-Sundrum brain tension. And it's known, of course, that to get sort of a nice flat four-dimensional flat brain, you need to have a fine tuning between the bulk cosmological constant and the brain tension itself. Now, if you do that, you can have sort of a holographic picture. I just drew schematically the right side of the Randall syndrome setup. If we think of ADS5 as originating from the near horizon of a stack of D3 brains, now the D brains basically interpolate between ADS and flat space, and we have some sort of boundary of anti-de-Sitter space. And as I indicated, what happens here in the RS model is you basically just cut off the space, and you can imagine by introducing this cutoff by hand, or sort of a slicing of the anti-de-Sitter space, you're specifying certain boundary conditions on that brain. Well, after that, one thing people noted was you can write the same Lagrangian if you wanted to and say, what if we relax the fine-tuning condition? What happens if the brain tension is not perfectly adjusted? And there's a simple picture, and various people looked at these codimension 1 domain wall solutions. But this scenario, and the trapping of a massive graviton was highlighted by Karsh and Randall, where they said, and hopefully it's almost an obvious statement, that if we have a fine-tuned brain tension, we end up with sort of a flat four-dimensional brain. If we increase the tension over the fine-tuned value, we have sort of a positive curvature of the Sitter brain world. Or the opposite is the one I'm more interested in, is if you have not enough tension, you end up with negative curvature in the four-dimensional sense. And you can imagine smoothly interpolating between these three types of scenarios just by sort of turning the crank or tuning the dial for the brain tension. From a bulk ADS point of view, you can also think about this. It's just sort of slicing your ADS5 space with various positive, negative, or flat slices. So within this general context, I wanted to ask what happens to the trapping of gravity. After all, that was one of the initial sort of interests in the Randall syndrome model. And sort of an interesting picture. We know in the standard flat brain, we have a massless zero-mode graviton, plus, of course, the continuum Kaluza-Klein states. In the de-Sitter brain world, you still have a massless zero-mode graviton. But in the anti-de-Sitter brain world, it turns out that there would have been a massless graviton bound to the brain, except that it's not a normalizable state from the four-dimensional point of view. And so apparently the proper interpretation of that is that it's sort of not really bound or not really trapped in the brain. And instead what happens is there's a very light would-be massless graviton that has a small mass to it. And so if I drew sort of a parameter space, this is the four-dimensional cosmological constant plotted on the x-axis and sort of the mass, so it's sort of a schematic of the graviton spectrum. The flat brain has a trapped graviton here plus a continuum tower. The de-Sitter brain has a massless graviton. There's a gap over here, and then a continuum tower. The gap is, of course, well known because it's sort of a unitarity region over here that you have to jump across. And I identify here basically the massive graviton in anti-de-Sitter space plus a discrete tower. Discrete, you can think of also because it's an anti-de-Sitter space with quantization. And so just to repeat myself a little bit, the ADS-ADS brain world has a massive graviton, and Karsh and Randall, Schwartz, Parati showed this sort of formula that the mass, this is the four-dimensional mass I'm talking about, the mass of the graviton, mass squared is proportional to the four-dimensional cosmological constant squared, and fifth-dimensional radius is just to get the units, correct? What that means, in a way, is you could think of mass as like Hubble parameter squared. So that it's basically practically massless, and you can think the Compton wavelength is much longer than the Hubble scale, so it ought not to have any real physical consequences or observable consequences. Except for this small thing about the Van Dam-Veltman discontinuity, which states that a graviton, even with a non-zero mass, even in the massless limit, is a physically inequivalent to a massive graviton, at least in the flat space limit. I wanted to go over that argument just a little bit. So you can just take just a very simple picture. Let's do linearized Einstein equations, for example. So we could just take sort of the four-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert reaction. And the claim is that sort of gauge invariance of this action protects the graviton from picking up in mass. And if you linearize the Einstein equations, you could write down in an appropriate gauge the propagator for a massless graviton. Looks in this form. Standard massless hole down here, and then some tensor structure, of course. And the feature is sort of the subtraction of the trace term over here, comes with coefficient 1. Now, if you sort of stick in a mass term by hand, and hopefully warning bells go off when you try to stick in mass by hand, but if you try to do it anyway, and there's a Pauli-Fiertz, so-called Pauli-Fiertz mass term that you just add, you end up with the propagation of a massive graviton of this nature. Of course, you have a massive pole over here. But the key feature is that there's a factor of 2/3 that's not mass dependent. And so if you now take the mass goes to zero limit of this propagator, say you sandwich it between two conserved currents, you'll actually see a physical consequence of this factor of 2/3. If you do a little calculation, you show that this massive propagator predicts the bending of light 3/4 that of the massless or the standard Einstein case. And so if this is really the end of the story, that's quite spectacular, I think, because it's sort of a theoretical proof that the graviton is truly massless. And this, of course, does not happen for a photon, for example. This is a effect from the graviton.
Well, of course, it happens equally badly, exactly in
Milton. That it does, actually, right. In fact, I think Van Dam and Veltman talked about that at the same time they talked about the gravity case.
Is it just not irreversible, or is it even
Gaussian?
You're right, but then there's physics.
All right.
If you just solve the field equations, just that it's not irreversible?
No, the point is it's not really a limit of the other.
That's true.
The proper way to do it is, of course, to give it mass through a Higgs mechanism or in a gauge invariant way, which we'll do at the end. Right? But before we get there, it turns out, of course, that even that statement of the Van Dam-Veltman discontinuity is different in anti de Sitter space. And so there's a rich structure to it, actually. And this is not our work. This was pointed out by Kogan et al. And Parati, that in a way, in anti de Sitter space, you've introduced another third dimensional scale, which is the Hubble scale. Now you can have an interplay between the Hubble scale and the Compton wavelength of the graviton. And then, depending on the order of limits, you may or may not run into this discontinuity. And so I've turned the previous diagram on the side. Now I plot mass of the graviton over here, the cosmological constant, with the Sitter space up here, ADS down below. Flat space is basically just the horizontal axes over here. And the general statement of the Van Dam-Veltman discontinuity is if you start with a massive graviton over here, you take the massless limit, you're always propagating 5 degrees of freedom, and it's not the same as the origin point over here, where you have a 2 degrees of freedom theory. On the other hand, if you look at sort of the linearized gravity with a mass term propagator, it has a form like that, where now the trace term has a more complicated structure. Alpha here is just this ratio of m squared over lambda. So you see, if I have a cosmological constant and mass goes to zero first, this gives me the standard factor of 1. If on the other hand I fix mass, take lambda goes to zero, then alpha blows up and I get that massive factor of 2/3. And you can imagine, depending on which slope I take to reach the origin, I can get any number in between. Now the ADS-ADS spring world model, the graviton mass and the four-dimensional cosmological constant are not independent parameters. Once you determine one, you do the calculation, the other one comes out. So there's actually a fixed sort of relation between the two, and I plotted schematically what it looks like over here. Remember, mass squared goes like lambda squared. You can imagine, if you go in this limit over here, it turns out to be a smooth limit to flat space. So this is the statement that, at least at the classical level, there's no discontinuity in the Karsh-Randall brain world. But we were still a little suspicious. Now, can 5 degrees of freedom really look like 2? And this is maybe a little redundant, because I think, or hopefully everyone should know the answer. If the 5 degrees of freedom, or if it's an interacting theory, they're not going to look like 2. But we can, you know, sort of go over the calculation step by step. So we looked at a little toy model for the brain world. And the problem with adding in mass is you're not quite sure how to do that in a good gauge invariant way, at least not at that time. So we said, let's just stick in a Pauli-Fierch mass term by hand and look at linearized gravity. So the theory is basically four-dimensional gravity with cosmological constant. To be consistent, we expand this for small h mu nu, for small fluctuations about an ADS background. To that, we add the graviton mass term, and let's couple it to a conserved stress energy tensor. Now this by itself breaks diffeomorphism invariance. It breaks gauge invariance, let's say. But there's actually a nice trick for restoring gauge invariance, which goes by the Stueckelberg formulation. It's basically, we can throw in an auxiliary field and sort of redefine our gauge transformations of the original graviton or whatever plus the auxiliary field, so that in conjunction with each other, you have gauge invariance. So I don't want to go through all the details, but basically, if you just look at the table over here, we start with a graviton, h mu nu, which we can break into traceless plus the trace modes. It's sort of a vector gauge invariance, so we throw in an auxiliary vector field, v mu. Once we have a gauge invariance, when you quantize, we gauge fix, that introduces a set of vector ghosts. The vector turns out to be a massive vector, so the best way to treat the quantization of the auxiliary vector is to do another Stueckelberg thing. We introduce an auxiliary scalar. Now we have vector gauge invariance, which we fix at the expense of a scalar ghost. Hopefully it's not quite as bad as it looks. We end up with gauge fixed action, which basically just has the tensor and scalar couplings to the source, ghost terms, which I'm not too interested in. Plus what's in green are the auxiliary fields that's been added. And the key feature about this is that the auxiliary fields do not couple to the conserved stress tensor. And what that means is, at least at tree level, they basically will not contribute. And that's another way, in a way, of seeing that there's no Van Den Veltman discontinuity. I do have to say, This coefficient depends on the mass, so there is that feature left over, of course. So at tree level, I can just integrate out the graviton field, and I find out.
See, alpha and lambda is m.
It's m squared divided by lambda. I believe this 2 minus alpha is spurious. I don't quite remember about that. This 2 minus 3 alpha, I think, is real. There is that, it's a De Sitter sort of thing. If mass and lambda are positive, I can get an infinity, a zero over here. And that corresponds to this partially massless theory where I propagate 4 degrees of freedom and I cannot couple to a trace over here. That just reproduces the well-known tree-level result. Question is, if you go to one loop order, you can ask what happens. And we just did a simple calculation of the vacuum-to-vacuum amplitude, or the one loop partition function. And basically, it's a quadratic action. So it's a very simple result like that. Again, what's in green are the new features due to the mass, which is the vector field, auxiliary vector, auxiliary scalar, and then an additional ghost. And it's pretty obvious if you compare that to the massless partition function. In a way, you're counting degrees of freedom in the one-loop partition function. You know these numbers are not going to agree. And so there is some sort of a discontinuity, or some, at least there are two different theories, let's say, at the quantum level. And you can count and verify 2 versus 5 degrees of freedom. Now we pointed out that there is this discontinuity, but to be fair, it is a sort of a quantum effect, and presumably it's not going to have anything as striking as a three-quarters bending of light effect. So it's more of a sort of theoretical or formal interest.
One second, if I were to do this, you say if I were to do this in QED,
Now we did cheat a little bit over here. In QED, presumably you'll still have 3 degrees of freedom for the massive photon, but the longitudinal mode would not couple to the stress tensor, to the conserved current. And even if it goes into loops, it's just going to add an overall constant to the partition function, or so it's not going to. So, I mean, this is raised as an objection, exactly, to what happens over here. The point is that this is actually sensitive to the background metric. And that's because gravity is a self-interacting theory. Now, if this was truly a gauge invariant theory, I can claim to write down an effective action for the gravity fields in a sort of a background field calculation. And then I can show that. I haven't actually done that. I suspect the answer is it's not going to show up.
What's not going to show up? As you
said, the third polarization state. In the massless limit. I mean, there's a massless limit going on, of course.
Oh, but we can just count, right? I mean, all you're doing is counting.
Well, the point is, this is supposed to be more than just counting. If it's just counting, I don't.
Counting? Where is it not counting?
It is a little more than just counting, because these are determinant. These are determinants evaluated in a background gravitational field. So the answer over here really is, say, Riemann squared terms.
Well, I thought you're trying to argue that the two are different and not equal, right?
Right. I want to argue that the functional form is not equal, not just an overall infinite constant is not equal.
Is the masses limit just the same as what you get if you started with the masses graviton plus a masses vector plus a scalar?
Yes.
Even
provided
the background dependence.
I think so. Provided that the scalars couple the gravity in just the same way, which means the right, mass term coefficient or something like that.
I don't see why I couldn't make the same argument in 2D.
I have to think about that. I mean, I'm not entirely happy with this. The thing you really want to do, I think, and this is meant to be a bit of a caveat, what you really want to do is calculate a quantum two-point function, like that, a quantum-corrected two-point function. And then you can ask, over here we know the additional states do not show up in this tree-level propagator. The claim here is that additional states will show up running in the loop, not in the external legs. But that the trilinear coupling over here will give rise to a different answer. I mean, I think this would be the real test in a way. That we haven't. But in a way, we're not too interested in the sort of break gauge invariance way of doing things over here. But it was an observation that at least plausible argument can be made at the quantum level is discontinuous.
I should know this because we've talked already before, but I keep forgetting. I mean, fundamentally, what we have is just five-dimensional gravity, right, with these brains and boundary conditions. So you could, rather than adding masses... And
forget about this, just work from a five-dimensional...
five-dimensional linearizer to whatever
right,
you want for
right.
calculation. And that should be the answer, right?
Right.
So... this is supposed to be, an easier way to get at the four-dimensional?
Well, partially this is meant to say, there's a bit of a duality, which I'd like to get to at the end, maybe, which states that sort of the classical five-dimensional brain world model is equivalent or at least dual to a four-dimensional, ADS-CFT, a four-dimensional CFT coupled to gravity, which means I should be able to do a completely four-dimensional calculation and reproduce the same results. And it would be a little test of duality to see if my quantum four-dimensional calculation is the same as my classical five-dimensional gravity.
You're trying to understand what kind of gravity you get in four dimensions.
Right. So, so this is, let's say, this is
you construct an apparent paradox, and then you try. You hope to learn something about resolve.
Right. Well, when we were doing this work, we're wondering if, there's actually something sick about this model. But I think we understand.
Well, I mean, from the five-dimensional point of view, there can't really be anything wrong with it.
Well, not so much sick as an inconsistent, maybe, but I mean, not reproducing Einstein gravity. I mean, that could be a consistent theory that's just tensor scalar gravity or something. It's not, but I'm just hypothetical about that. So this was meant as sort of a toy model exploration of four-dimensional physics of the bent brain world. But I'm trying to say a little bit on the slide over here that, well, the models are not necessarily, I can't really claim that I'm doing the same thing.
So it wouldn't have been a paradox if it turned out that it doesn't reproduce that same gravity in four dimensions. That would have been quite a reasonable possibility.
That's a possibility. The five-dimensional model just does not reproduce Einstein gravity. Although, I mean, that's contrary to what's in the literature. And it turns out, of course, that it's okay. So, yeah, of course, the ADS brain world is not or toy model. From a five-dimensional point of view, it has Kaluza-Klein, graviton towers, and presumably there's some good five-dimensional version of general covariance that should protect whole picture. So one sort of picture that solves all the problems, I think, is to imagine if the mass of the graviton in this four-dimensional picture really comes from something like a gravitational Higgs mechanism. Say the massive spin 2. This is sort of a Kaluza-Klein type analog. It's really just a massless graviton that eats a massless vector, that eats a massless scalar, put them all together, and it develops mass. And so we wanted to focus a little bit on, can we generate graviton mass through something like a Higgs mechanism, or at least a gauge-invariant way of doing that. And turns out this was a point of view espoused by Stanley Deser, but also Massimo Perotti, that general covariance in itself does not necessarily imply that the graviton has to remain massless in anything. Now, you can argue about what it really means to have gauge invariance, or this general covariance. And the argument through a QED analog is to say, if I look at the self-energy in QED, if I want to impose my Ward identity, so I have a transverse sort of term over here, times pi of p squared, and this corrects the propagator of the photon, of course, in the denominator, p squared plus pi, like that. Now, if it just so happens that pi of p squared does not start at p squared, but starts with the constant term over here, then this actually shifts the pole of the photon and gives it mass. Now, this, of course, is just another kind of way of looking at a Higgs mechanism, if I wanted to. The non-local p mu, p nu over p squared term comes out from integrating out Goldstone boson exchange. Mm-hmm. So whether you call this just, you know, Goldstone boson, Higgs mechanism, or something like that, the claim here is you still have, at least you're still satisfying your standard QED Ward identity.
I think this, maybe Deser pointed out that this goes back to Schwinger.
I see.
Well, that's what
happened. Well, there's the Schwinger model.
Yeah.
Where
the Schwinger model was invented to illustrate a point that Schwinger made before, earlier. Famous paper called Gauge Invariance.
Wow.
It's in this, you know, this famous collection of QED paper. Beautiful paper.
Huh.
Anyway, so
it's an old Schwinger result.
And the Schwinger model was invented, but it didn't lead to the Higgs mechanism.
But the Schwinger model was in the early 60s.
Right.
But remember, the Higgs is in the middle 60s.
He missed it.
Sorry?
Schwinger missed it, you said. He could have. He was close.
Schwinger might have understood something about it.
Hmm.
Yeah. Somehow, because of the Schwinger model, he was satisfied with something. Maybe there was something dynamical, not something you could just see in that.
Classical action.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, we ask if the same thing could happen with the graviton. And in particular, is it possible to, say, have a conformal field theory or matter loops correcting the graviton propagator? And in a way,
when Nagel does not loops, it's a tree graph.
It is a tree graph.
Which is sort of like your other model where you had the graviton mixing with these other fields.
Right.
Now you want to try to do it with loops.
Yeah. Well, in a way, you can identify it's a composite state.
Mm-hmm.
It's a composite two-particle state. So that it comes out of a loop.
Because for the photon, we know loops work in two dimensions, not higher dimensions, because the infrared is, suppressed.
This is an infrared issue. I mean, this whole thing has, the mass comes from a non-local type or an infrared.
Mm-hmm.
But there are cases where it can happen. Think about
okay, you say, right, that's really the same thing.
Hmm.
It's not a CFT, but it's,
yeah. Well, it's just schematic of the setup. afraid I switch over to handwritten transparencies.
One second. Are you, you're not going to write down something where this will happen in the class photo?
I'm sorry?
You're not going to write down something where this will happen in the class photo?
No, it's going to be a one loop effect.
No one's ever been able to write down something where the class that we break in.
You mean a real analog of the Higgs effect, yeah, where you just add another field and shift that?
You need a vector field.
You need a vector ghost number. Yeah. So in here we identify, or actually Massimo Prati in a nice paper set up the framework for this. We're just following up on it. Identifies sort of a vector Goldstone boson as a composite two-particle state. And that shows up.
What do you mean identify? In what context?
There is sort of a, well, I don't know if identify is the right word.
For the mechanism you're talking about, obviously, you can take a vector
right
boson. But where that comes from is a dynamical question.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So he had a toy model of a conformally coupled skater in anti de Sitter space, coupled to gravity. So simple gravity plus skater field.
Gravity plus skater field
in anti de Sitter space.
Gravity plus
skater field.
How's the skater coupled?
It's just a conformally coupled skater.
Okay. Well, that's the theory.
So that's the theory.
With a cosmological method.
Right.
Where's the vector? There's no vector field there.
No, but in a way.
So he's made an argument that there's a dynamical symmetry breaking?
It is dynamical, that it is.
But
now,
I mean, I would find that pretty amazing to be able to establish that. How could he establish that?
Well, from a group theory point of view, and that is,
well, this is
well, the symmetries allow it. So then you do a calculation, and
but it's a dynamical issue. I mean, you're trying to generate a bound state in a theory which isn't a normal. I mean, I don't know what you're doing, what the argument is. The Schwinger model, or you know, the Technicolor, where you rely on QCD-like analogs to generate bound states, but nobody can do it analytically. Here you're just saying there's a kinematical possibility or there's a dynamical reason.
Well, I like to say it comes out of the dynamics.
That's a hard calculation. I mean, does chiral symmetry breaking come out of the dynamics of QCD? Much easier case.
That's easier.
Well, it's much easier than dealing with this.
How does Massimo argue?
Which is non-normal.
Yeah, I mean, how does Massimo argue that you actually get a vector?
Oh, well, I'm going to actually go over the argument over here. So maybe we can look at that and you can argue the point. Basically, he calculates the self-energy of the graviton through a single scalar loop.
So this happens in one loop?
This is one loop.
In
an anti de Sitter background. And what he's looking for is
not a dynamical effect, then. It's not a bound state.
The mass generated is small compared to the ADS curvature. So it's not.
No, I understand. Still, you're getting two particles to behave.
I see the point. I mean, just a one loop thing is not going to show necessarily a bound state. But what he identifies is basically a massless vector, or at least the appropriate E naught equals 4 vector.
You have to get these things to behave like a vector.
Well, maybe I can try to go through this, and then you can point out the question. So. For the graviton self-energy, we have a little more complicated tensor structure. And this is a simplified argument over here that the self-energy, I pulled out a Lorentz invariant, pi of p squared piece, times, this is sort of the transverse traceless projection. And there can be a transverse but trace piece, which I'm leaving out over here. And we resum the graviton propagator with the self-energy. And just like in the QED case, if pi of p squared has a constant piece, the constant piece will shift the pole in the propagator. So the name of the game here is to sort of calculate the self-energy and find what pi of p squared is and see whether it starts at p to the 4 for the gravity case over here, or if it pulls out a constant leading piece like that. Now, of course, mass squared times this thing, all these d's have these p mu, p nu over p squared, is basically looking for a non-local term. Now, in anti-de Sitter space, it's a curved background. You don't have sort of translation invariance necessarily. So there's no simple Fourier transform. So this is just a sort of schematic picture. What we actually calculate is the two-point function in coordinate space, t mu nu of x, t mu nu at point y. And so the resulting self-energy is basically a bilocal tensor, point x, point y, and you can see the long distance behavior coming out of that. It's a technical calculation, so I'll present the answer to that. But before we get there, there is an unusual feature in an anti-de Sitter space that the boundary conditions that you impose on these fields are quite important. This was realized even, I think, Avis, Isham, and Story had a sort of quantum fields in curved space 20 years ago or more, I think, where they pointed this out. If you have, for example, a scalar field, I can compute the scalar propagator, scalar two-point function in coordinate space, x and y. And we know the short distance singularity is exactly what you want, 1 over 4 pi squared, and separation squared like that. But in this scheme of working in homogeneous coordinates, you can always you can always add terms that solve sort of the homogeneous equation, such that you satisfy appropriate boundary conditions. And just as an example, for a conformally coupled scalar, you have a standard 1 over x minus y squared propagator, which corresponds in the end to a transparent boundary condition. Or you can sort of add image charges at sort of antipode points and sort of the pseudo five-dimensional hyperboloid. This is just like doing, you know, old-fashioned E and M image charges. Now, standard field theory tends to impose reflecting boundary conditions, which are the ones down here, basically because anti-de Sitter space is our space, and we have a problem. We don't want information to come in or out of the space, so we just let it reflect at the boundary. But it turns out that in the Karshan-Randall model, you really want to have transparent boundary conditions. And so we can encode the sort of feature boundary conditions in parameters I called alpha plus and alpha minus. Alpha plus is just a factor here. They're constant factors. Alpha plus is always 1. I always want to have the right short distance behavior. And alpha minus is either 0, 1, or minus 1.
The boundary here is the ADS.
This is the boundary of ADS.
It's a plot, but there's got a brain there. So.
Oh, this is a whole four-dimensional calculation. So this is the three-dimensional boundary of ADS4.
So three-dimensional boundary of ADS4.
Why is it transparent?
So why should I use transparent boundary conditions? I looked at sort of the Karshan-Randall model. I can write ADS-5 in coordinates, in five-dimensional coordinates of this point of view. And basically, I want to take the negative curvature slice of ADS-5 as my sort of four-dimensional universe. And in this set of coordinates, I just take a slice at constant z over here, and then sort of a schematic picture where the ball is ADS-5. Then the boundary of ADS-5 is basically just outside over here. And what I do is I take a slice of ADS-5, and this is my four-dimensional universe at constant z-naught over here. But you see, if I take this slice, and I say this is yellow space, is what I basically keep. Then I have not sort of sliced away all of the boundary of ADS-5. And so the bulk space is, in fact, sees both the four-dimensional brain world plus the original boundary of ADS-5. And so there's several boundaries and things like that to worry about. There's the original boundary of ADS-5. There's the boundary, which is really your, you know, Planck brain or whatever brain you call. And then there's the boundary of ADS-4, which touches the boundary of ADS-5 over here. And the transparent boundary conditions are the ones imposed on the circles over here.
Does transparent mean that things can leave without a trace?
Yeah, exactly. Now, if I look
that's not what you find in the actual dynamics of this model. I mean, they can leave, but they have to come back in at the very end.
Okay, and this is maybe too simple. They should be able to come back in.
That's haven't you assumed a particle that's oscillating when you find that result? I mean, you can imagine a particle that just leaves one holographic domain. It just stays in the other.
So. No, well, not really, because you have to satisfy the equation of motion for the particle.
But we're assuming a GPS.
Well, I'm not assuming it's going to follow a GPS.
Maybe it goes through there and something else hits it, and it goes off in another trajectory.
Well, just look at part of the trajectory when you're in the bulk, and it goes through a different, that's the whole point, it goes through a different holographic domain. At that time, at least, nothing special happens. Maybe it comes back later, but at least at that time, nothing really happens.
All I'm trying to say is it's basically just like delayed reflecting boundary conditions.
Well, maybe
that's the generic.
That's the best way to say it.
Maybe we expect. I don't know whether that's
important. Well, to encode that in a four-dimensional sense, I think there's something complicated going on the three-dimensional boundary, if you wish. But in a way, it's not going to be ordinary reflecting conditions.
I mean, it's as if you glue your ADS-4 world to another ADS-4 world, and everything that exits from yours has to enter the other one, and then follow the equation of motion, which usually bring it back in after.
Right, I think that's fair. Well, we just use the simple alpha plus and alpha minus to represent boundary conditions. Then a rather long and tedious and pretty ugly calculation. I can go into a little more detail if you want, but I think I can just present the end result. Has the self-energy as a bilocal tensor in a form like that. It actually turns out to be a reasonably simple result. There's something universal at the one loop level, at least.
This is the T mu.
Just T mu, two-point.
You're just contracting graviton fields. And
only scalar and spin 1/2 and so on in a loop.
The graviton laws contribute.
Right, they do. We're ignoring that. If I'm thinking about the large n limit, then the CFT, large n limit of UN, being Mills. The point is I'm going to have more matter on the four-dimensional sense than the gravity itself. So basically I'm thinking about a lot of matter coupled to a graviton. So obviously there is... I'm sorry, Matt?
It's the CFT.
is assuming there are a lot of fields in the CFT coupled to gravity. So gravity is just one field, and it's your hand fields.
Right, it's basically just
that. Just scalar.
So scalars, spin 1/2 and spin 1. We don't do the graviton loop itself. That is going to run into all the standard issues with quantum gravity. It's interesting that it's a universal structure. These are all massless particles. It's meant to represent. I'm not saying it's finite. They're short distance contact terms, which. Right. What I didn't write are all the delta functions and derivatives of delta functions that show up over here. There is a universal structure for these massless fields that comes in an interesting ratio, 1, 3, and 12. That's the same ratio that comes into the Weyl squared part of the conformal anomaly. And Z is the only sort of invariant I can create out of my X and Y fields. And there's a little bit of a symmetry between sort of the X minus Y terms and the X plus Y terms over here.
Where did the X plus Y terms come from?
They came from the images in the propagator itself.
Z minus 1 is proportional to X plus Y?
Z minus 1 should be X plus Y. And there's an additional constraint I didn't write down, that X squared equals minus L squared. Basically, these are five-dimensional coordinates constrained to live on a hyperbola. So it's all hidden inside here. And there's some complicated tensor structure, which I'm not writing down either. The question is, can we identify in this sort of self-energy, you know, some non-local term that's proportional to just sort of this transverse traceless part? And we're looking for non-local. We're looking for large distances. So we can actually take the same self-energy and expand it for large separations. X minus Y being large corresponds to Z being large. And so I can expand this in inverse powers of Z to the N, and I get terms like that. Now there's an interesting interplay between even and odd powers of Z that show up over here. And if you look at what the transverse traceless part of it looks like, the transverse traceless part, basically, you know, G mu nu minus P mu, P nu over P squared, whatever it is for gravity, is non-local. So it also has non-local terms of that form. The leading part of that is 1 over Z to the 5. And so the claim is that this leading 1 over Z to the 5 behavior of the self-energy corresponds to this part of the self-energy. I've identified a coefficient of this out of the self-energy. I can work out an equation for the mass, which has this universal structure over here times some prefactors, and dependent on boundary conditions. Now what happens over here is standard reflecting boundary conditions, alpha plus and alpha minus are both like, you know, 1 or minus 1. They cancel out. I can also think of standard boundary conditions as having a good four-dimensional parity. And then I get rid of all these odd powers over here, and it's the odd powers that I needed to identify, in a way, the Goldstone vector part of this. I can argue whether this is actually proof or not. But, the claim is that it is identifying an appropriate constant part times the transverse traceless structure.
What we're saying, the mass term corresponds to the coefficient of P5.
mass term corresponds to the coefficient of the transverse traceless tensor over here. So it turns out these are not the same tensor. So you can now make a claim, well, which is that supposed to be mass or is it supposed to be something different? Now I would say all you need to do is match the leading order term over here at large distances. And then there's other non-local terms that show up.
Large distances compared to what?
Compared to the...
Is on the sphere.
Right. Well, it's a hyperboloid, really. So large distances compared to L, the ADS scale.
There's an extra inference.
Mass term is by comparison to the free mass that propagated. If I can't go through a pole in momentum space, how do I know it's mass?
Well, I can still. It's not momentum space.
Right. Because you're not going to say,
but I can still resum these sort of expressions in terms of non-local expressions.
But you have those various tensors in your ADS, so
right.
Which one in the combination is the mass term? But, just not obvious.
Oh.
let's look at the calculation. Where's the calculation?
You mean this result here?
Right. Well, I look at that. The short distance behavior.
I don't see the short distance. I've dropped all short distance behavior over here. I've dropped all contact terms.
No, okay. But the behavior for x of what plus to y is long. Right. Then you have this extra terms of fall off the large distances.
Why is that a mass?
What would I get in fat space?
It all goes away in fat space.
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't all go away in fat space. There's an answer in fat space.
There's no mirror terms.
Sorry?
There's no mirror terms. There's no,
there's no mirror terms, but there is a Kirkland function. On the other hand, L.
It goes away because L goes to infinity.
Yeah,
for that reason.
Why should it go away?
Why is there not something you learn 1 over x to the fourth that survives?
What the?
I mean, there is. What is it? There is a 2-point function with stress density.
In flat space, there is, right. One thing is.
It else in the definition of Z, so it doesn't really go away.
Doesn't go away. What the one goes away, it all becomes.
Right. Just becomes an ordinary domain.
Except in the power of
1 over separation. Yeah. Two is 1 over separation of the A for teach for the teacher's 2-point function.
Yeah. That would be, 1 over X to the A.
It looks like a normal flat space. 2-point function.
No.
But,
yeah. I would. So if I were looking at the 2-point function in position space, in flat space, I would argue that there's no mass cost. Something that falls off like a power of a large x.
Well, 1 over x to the 8 is too fast.
Sorry?
Yeah,
1 over x to the 8.
You want something like one of a square, or you want something that bounces up like a Higgs pole?
No, 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 this isn't a pole. No, this is just a correlation function. So I'm trying to differentiate between a pi, which goes, which is an analytic, and a square. Mm-hmm. So it's Fourier transform. But that's not, actually not an analytic, it has a logarithm. It's Fourier transform falls off fast enough. But here it seems to fall off fast enough.
Well, this pi is not directly the key two-point function. I mean, it's related to it.
Yes.
This is the two-point function.
With the tensor structure outside of it. With the sub fold out, right?
With
the sub fold out. With one over p squared fold out. G mu traces. So it's something which, you know, if things were analytic, okay, it would go like p fourth log p squared.
Right,
p fourth log p squared, and Fourier transform, then.
This is a four dimension. It is a 1 over x to the 8.
It's going to go 1 over x to the 8.
And that's what you expect.
Right. But this also goes 1 over x to the 8.
I think it would go like e to the 4th in Fudge space. It wouldn't have a constant piece.
Sorry?
The thing you call pi would go like e to the 4th in Fudge space. It wouldn't have a constant piece.
Well, I didn't, actually, it should go like 1 over x to the 8 for an object. Right? Flat space. Oh, I see. But now, so I'm just trying to identify where the difference is. And the difference is, you see those terms, 3z squared plus 1?
Are those important ones because they have positive powers of z?
Yeah, because if you let L go to infinity first, or x go to infinity, the limits of x goes to infinity.
Good. Okay.
So in fact, that changes the power from 1 over x to the 8th. 1 over x to the 6th, right?
6 or order
4. 1 over x to the 4th.
Oh, from here.
Good.
1 over x to the 4th is like getting rid of 4 powers.
So somehow there are longer distance correlations in this space than there are in...
I think it has to be longer in ADS in order to generate a mass. Mm-hmm.
But really weird. I mean, it's got to be like somehow the Schwinger model where these things are, you know, these guys are behaving like a single particle, right?
Yeah.
The Schwinger model, they're all going on a line,
right?
And two fermions can behave like a vector.
Yeah.
And you can't tell the difference. But
I guess it has to
hard
be
hard to do that in more than one dimension.
Okay, right.
Somehow ADS is. But ADS is not that much of a confining potential.
Does that mean ADS 5 also?
I suspect it would. But now this is a boundary condition issue, of course.
Right.
And the standard.
So this would cancel if you said, looks like if you said alpha plus.
If I set alpha plus and alpha minus to be the same, the term.
It adds up.
Well, the
maybe you have a sign going on.
No, I think the sign is correct over here. There is a. It's not quite the leading term.
Sorry? It better be exactly the leading term. It's got to be the term that goes like 1 over x to the 4th. Term. 1 over x to the 4th is the Fourier transform of an m squared. It's actually.
Right.
The
term we identify, actually, I had to think about that. You're right. The term we identify is the one that falls off as 1 over z to the 5 times this t over here. Now these
transform of an m squared.
1 over x to the 4.
Right. Which is what you have there, alpha plus squared plus alpha minus squared.
Yeah. See, there is this term over here.
Yeah, which is the leading
term. That's the leading term. I'm identifying this term over here.
Why?
That's involved with the vector propagation. There's, I have to be a little bit, I'm a little sloppy. I am a little sloppy over here, you're right. There is a one over.
The leading term, of course, is not really a master neither, because it's really, there's a constant before you transform to get delta function. Delta, right? Delta 4 of x. So it's a really log of p squared.
Isn't the log of
that? Something which gives a 1 over x to the 4th, it's got to be a log of p squared. So, and the next power could be just a piece, but then it's not a mass. So, it vanishes. And it seems that
well, there's, I think,
it's stronger than a mass.
I see. There's a tensor structure that has to start off, I think, as.
Well, because you say it behaves like a vector particle, the spin of this object is a vector.
I think, yeah.
Sorry, that's still not okay.
Well, you've raised a good point. I don't have a good answer for that, I suppose. Part of this was just turning the crank in a way, because you could identify at least part of.
What does plus plus mean? That's a light term?
Oh, I'm sorry. Where, I don't think I had.
Pi plus plus.
Oh, sorry. Transverse traceless. It's my bad version of TT. And basically, this thing over here is what I call pi TT.
Right.
And the Fourier transform of this, or rather, whatever it is in Nt de Sitter space, is this equation over here, plus a bunch of dots, which I did not write down. This actually has a leading 1 over z to the 4 piece, which I did not write down. So that, I think, is what you would expect.
compared to the 5 and the 6 and 4 and
everything.
Isn't it natural to keep the first term?
The first term corresponds to, in some sense, a scalar part of this, if I try to read between the lines.
Is it also a T4 in there?
There's also a T4. So yeah, there should be a T4 here plus this. And then I think the correct thing to do is to match the T4 in here with that, but also to expect the term 1 down over here, because I am thinking about scalar versus.
I would try to match it with the exchange of some intermediate object.
Well, this part I wrote down here corresponds to the exchange of a vector.
Oh, I see.
That's why this part was interesting. This T5, T7 and so on.
So there's a part which
there's a part that looks like an exchange,
and there's a part that looks
like a scalar, right?
Which is what you might very well expect, since you need both. So
exactly, and the part that looks like a scalar falls off as T4 term here. Part that looks like a vector goes like T to the T5 here.
I just don't understand it physically. The anti-de Sitter potential well is strong enough to hold these two particles together to look like a massless single particle.
Well, it looks like a massive. single particle.
No, the thing that the Goldstone boson.
It's a massive Goldstone boson.
So we're just very looking for the ADS radiation.
And these are,
I don't know, the focusing property of ADS space is what's doing it.
But it's doing it, you know, almost, it's somehow in all dimensions.
But presumably, it's not a very well localized sort of downstate.
It's behaving like a particle. Yeah, it's like, well, just like a Schwingel bond. It's exactly the same as Schwingel bond. You have your electron and your positron behaving like a particle that couples to a photon. And they propagate like a single. Of course, on a line, that's no big deal.
That's, okay, right.
But in three dimensions.
Well, I still find it kind of curious. This factor of 160 took quite a lot of time chasing down. Let me just wrap things up, I guess. That was the calculation, but we wanted to apply this to the bent brain room scenario. So if you go back to sort of the transparent boundary conditions for the Carson-Randall brain world, and you use both ADS CFT and just the standard brain world Newton's constant relation, you find a result. Alpha here is essentially the central charge of the four-dimensional CFT. It's not conventional factors, but they're factors that make these equations look a little better. Then we're claiming that the one loop sort of Higgs mechanism or gravity mass, the dynamical calculation, gives you a mass for the graviton of this form over here. Now some of this you can understand from dimensional grounds. The self-energy has kappa on both sides times t mu nu, t mu nu. So there's one factor of Newton's constant. The central charge just says how many particles are running through the loop. And to make the dimensions work out in the conformal field theory, only thing else you have is basically the scale of anti-de-Sitter space. If I use the above given relations, that's the same as this equation over here. And if you look up,
and is the radius?
Lambda's the cosmological constant. So it's 1 over L, it's 3 over L squared.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting result, I think, that you actually see sort of a quantum mechanical or one loop mass generation. And it agrees with the classical Carson-Randall calculation. And this is sort of an analog with what we had looked at earlier, where a four-dimensional quantum calculation gives you a correction to Newton's law in the Randall-Sundrum model. And that reproduces the Giddings, Katz, and Randall result of the classical five-dimensional calculation. This is what I wanted to highlight, the feature between this quantum and classical sort of duality. Now let me just finish with the thought that we solved this mass with a one-loop calculation. There's a question, do you really expect everything to agree with a simple one-loop calculation or not? If I'm thinking about this as sort of a strongly coupled dual CFT, you know, maybe one-loop free fields is not exactly sufficient, and yet somehow the numbers do seem to come out. I think it's still.
It could be, yeah. This is just the kinematics of particles in the ADS like this. Certainly, didn't you expect if this happens that the same thing would happen for the photon propagator?
I believe so, but
for the current correlation,
right?
Due to gravity, particularly, it just keeps particles like this stay together. And that's a much easier calculation to do. Have you done that?
No, I was planning on doing that. But I think it would be right. I find it surprising that once you relax the boundary conditions, perhaps whether it's true or not, everything starts picking up mass in this manner, dynamically.
Reflecting boundary conditions instead?
Oh, this disappears with reflecting boundary conditions.
what I learned about is that it seems that it's easy to modify the Clark-Schneider model in such a way that effective boundary conditions will be appropriate, but nothing else changes. So if you put in the brain here,
right?
And then you throw this part away.
Right.
And there's nothing that stops you from putting another brain here with the same tension and throwing this part away. And then you expect and that. And then you could do a
Z2 or something that makes it reflect.
And that makes it reflective. But otherwise, you haven't really changed anything.
But once you do that, I'm not sure you have a massive graviton anymore.
Massive,
because you have a... because your massless mode survives, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
So you need to have that feature of dropping the massless graviton. So. But actually, I mean, we thought if you're looking at a supersymmetric model, presumably not just the graviton, but all its superpartners, ought to get a mass as well. And you speculate that if this is some dynamical breaking of general covariance, maybe there's some dynamical breaking of supersymmetry as well, due to these boundary effects. So let me just say, you know, it's still a little bit mysterious, but I find it something fascinating to try to understand a little better.
I'm so confused by your box now. The lower right is this calculation of what happens in flat for non-idiots.
This is a flat four dimensions.
And the so what's the lambda four and the line of that's not really, the line of O is a different calculation which has non-zero.
Yeah, sorry.
Kind of agreement.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. They're two different things.
Yes,
all right, thank you.